This conversation is part two of a conversation that we had about Dr. Jordan Peterson. Part one can be found directly next to this one. And in that episode, you'll find an introduction to the thought of Jordan Peterson and why he's so influential, as well as rules 1 through 5 from his book, 12 Rules for Life. In this episode, part two, we will discuss rules 6 through 12, as well as kind of conclude the conversation and wrap up the ideas from both part one and part two. Hope you enjoy. Number 6, set your house in perfect order before you criticize the world. Sounds a little bit like don't remove the splinter in your neighbor's eye when you have a log in your own.
Yep. Very biblical.
Is it how, since you've read it more recently, would he distinguish it from that very much?
I wouldn't say so. I honestly can't remember a lot of specifics from this rule for some reason.
I'm going to guess that it has to do with, he talks about orderliness in particular. Uh-huh. So not just like, don't be a hypocrite, but is this where make your bed comes in?
I can't remember.
It might be where make your bed comes in, unless that comes in earlier multiple times, but it's about controlling the things you can control, controlling your own life, and then look at the world, right? If you're not making your bed every morning, not that I don't actually believe that making your bed is a literal thing. Like, I don't think it's literally making the bed is your thing you have to do in order to be orderly. Mm-hmm. As someone who doesn't always make my bed. But the concept of setting your house in order, literally, like making sure that things are tidy and in order, and then going out into the world. I really think this is where he talks about making your bed. I could be wrong, but it would make sense in that context of you make your bed. That's one thing that you've accomplished, right? Now you have the feeling of competence and confidence to then go out and engage with the world.
Right. Yeah, that's good. It makes sense. Yeah, the thrust of this rule that I kind of remember is from the chapter is, you know, all this craziness goes on in the world. You know, it's very loud all across the media. And I think the tendency, I know for me, the tendency is to think, you know, what's wrong with them and what does quote unquote our world need to do? And, you know, the basic point that he makes in there is, you know, maybe the issue is me and maybe the world would be a ton better if I could just make simple improvements to my own life.
Yeah. Well, it's like, it goes back to Chesterton again. What's wrong with the world?
Right.
I am.
Right.
Right. Yeah. That needs to be our, and I think this is a Peterson thing as well. That needs to be our first instinct. You know, Peterson was influenced by the Russian authors. I get a chance to say this because I haven't said this yet. But Dostoevsky, my boy. Alexander Solzhenitsyn.
Solzhenitsyn.
Yeah. I've read an essay. I read the speech he gave to Americans, which is cool. But one of his kind of principles that Peterson gets from there is like the line between good and evil lies in the heart of every man, right? Every man is capable of great good and great evil, right? And you need to recognize that you too are capable of great evil. And that's the starting point.
Right.
I'm going to let you go on your soapbox for number 7.
Oh, let's see.
I'll read it.
Yeah, sounds good.
Soapbox. Pursue what is meaningful, not what is expedient.
Yeah, this is really good. He talks a lot about like the essentially the evolutionary roots of delayed gratification and how it has been really, really, really important in human development that we discovered that we could delay gratification. So basically we could, you know, remove immediate pleasure to have a greater degree of satisfaction and fulfillment and pleasure later. It's a like a really significant, particularly human achievement to discover this. So that's one of the things he mentions in this is like, you know, delaying gratification is a really important element of our humanity that we should, you know, that I think in our society, the tendency is to not use that. It's just pursue the immediate pleasure. And that leads to deep unhappiness as a human being.
Yeah.
Have a thought on that?
So the pursuing what is meaningful rather than the expedient is directly connected with delayed gratification.
That's right.
So delayed gratification allows us to pursue things that bring meaning, deeper meaning than immediate pleasure.
That's right.
Okay.
Correct. Makes sense.
And how does this connect to Nietzsche's criticisms of Christianity?
So, you know, he goes on a little bit of a tangent here that I may or may not be able to connect to this rule number seven, but he throws it in here about, he references Friedrich Nietzsche a lot, the famous German philosopher who claimed that God is dead.
Mm-hmm. Also, by the way, Nietzsche died in, I think, 1904.
So okay.
Just for the record,
gotcha.
Nietzsche is dead.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Okay. Yeah, his thought was that, you know, Western modernity had moved on from the idea of God. And his claims are, and Jordan Peterson mentions this, are really striking and I think valuable for Christians to hear. And you know, maybe this will be tied to rule number seven here. And I'm just going to mention a few things that he says in the book. Let's see, here's one thing. Nietzsche thought that modern Christianity had removed moral responsibility from Christ's followers, that they had watered down the idea of the imitation of Christ, and that they had devalued the significance of earthly life, since only the afterlife mattered. So that was one of the things that Nietzsche believed, was that, hey, these Christians, like, because they, you know, quote unquote, believe that Christ's sacrifice redeemed humanity once and for all, they really haven't felt that following the example of Christ and living a holy earthly life, working for good, mattered at all.
Mm-hmm.
They just have basically eliminated the idea of that because they think Christ has redeemed humanity with his sacrifice on the cross.
Yeah.
Which, oh man, what a powerful, powerful, powerful and honest thing to say. I mean, say what you want about Nietzsche, but he was poking a very soft spot and true spot in Christianity of his day, most likely, is that most Christians do not live according to the real example and call of Christianity.
Yeah, and I guess that's what's powerful about Peterson, kind of, is how heavily he's influenced by Nietzsche, while at the same time influenced by the Old Testament.
Right.
Right? Like, you can't box him in as a thinker, and it's one of the things I like about him. He's such a free-thinking intellectual. But, yeah, like, he doesn't agree with everything Nietzsche says, but, like, he sees his critique of Christianity as powerful. And I think this is one of the reasons why Peterson likes, at least in his public-facing language, to remain outside of Christianity, in a sense, to be able to critique it from the outside. And I think that's something he certainly does, like Nietzsche, even if in a lot of ways he isn't,
right?
A Nietzsche disciple.
Right. Yeah, for me, you know, Peterson believed that no one has spoken more effectively as a encounter to Christianity than Nietzsche. That's what Peterson believes. And, you know, in a lot of ways, I see that point. You know, it's like, this is real that Christians don't behave in their call. You know, they largely don't. And for me, that's motivating as a Christian, you know, that I need to make sure that I align myself to imitate Christ as much as possible. Now, a huge element, if not the central element of Christianity, is that Christ continually redeems us imperfect souls and saves us from our imperfections one day at a time. But, you know, still, it's motivating for me each day to pursue what is meaningful, to pursue the imitation of Christ each day, because the people who aren't are looking. And basing their opinions of is Christianity true, is it not, on our example.
Yeah, wonderful. And I think of, just to stay a little bit longer on this rule, I think of how important it is to pursue meaning, whether that's in literature, whether that's in just in making time for those things that we find meaningful, because those are going to be the ways where we encounter God as well, right? And to not spend our life doing things, And I know it's about delayed gratification, this rule, but like to not spend our life doing things we don't find meaningful,
right?
As well, to allow time to pursue meaning. I think of Dostoevsky, one of my favorite quotes, still my email signature at work. Man is a mystery. It needs to be unraveled. If you spend your whole life studying that mystery, don't say that you've wasted your time. It's just like studying the mystery of man. If whatever finds you find meaningful in the mystery of creation, the mystery of human beings, like pursue that.
Good stuff.
Numero ocho. Dude, I'm so stoked for this one.
Yeah, this is maybe my favorite.
Absolutely. Hands down. Maybe like hands halfway down.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell the truth. Or at least
finish. Don't lie. Oh, gotcha. Thank you.
Probably heard me whisper.
You could have signaled to me with like a hand or something.
I could have, but I just wasn't thinking. So. You could
like pointed at me or something.
Tell the truth, or at least don't lie. Dude, we had a whole conversation. We've had a lying conversation on this podcast before. But honestly, this has impacted me greatly. Like, it goes back. I think it does tie in really closely to our lying conversation and just the importance of the second we allow ourselves to tell little lies, we start going down a slope towards living a life that's not true, living a life that's not true to ourself, true to God, true to others. I don't know. I think it just becomes such a slippery slope.
Yeah, it does. I agree. Yeah, I remember I was listening to Pines of Aquinas, actually, and Matt had on this guy who was a cocaine addict and had been hiding it from his wife. Did you listen to that episode?
I have heard that one, yeah.
Yeah, he'd been hiding that he was a cocaine addict from his wife for like literally 15 years. It's unbelievable. Yeah. And it finally came out. He was arrested, caught with cocaine and arrested. And I remember him saying he was talking about how he was in the prison cell and he said he just blurted out like almost involuntarily. He goes, "At least I don't have to lie anymore."
Wow.
And like he just blurted that out involuntarily, like it wasn't even like the thing he meant to say. And so that really struck me as something like, man, there's something about human beings, about the innate human experience that just demands truth, and like the absence of truth in our lives is just leads to disintegration. And I know that to be true in my own life. My gosh, I know how hard it is to be honest with myself sometimes. Mm-hmm. And to just like to admit like, yeah, in my life, for example, I'm bored right now, or like just in general, and like it's just really hard to be honest with myself sometimes, and how like that is the path of fulfillment and meaning and peace, is just being honest.
Well, and here's the thing. Most of the time, the lies that we tell, like the lies that we excuse, like we think are okay to tell, we do to try to protect people, but we just hurt them by doing it, right? And so this is where, and a key distinction, tell the truth or at least don't lie. Like he emphasizes that. Like we're not going to be perfect in telling the truth. We're going to be wrong, right? We can't tell the truth perfectly all the time. The truth can be elusive at times, confusing, where we have false opinions. Like we can't do that perfectly. But we can not intentionally lie. The negative kind of threw me off there. We can...
Yeah, you said
at least not lie.
yeah, you're right. You said it right.
But like these things we tell, like or tell ourselves, and I just would challenge you as a listener, like next time you're tempted, like, and you catch yourself of like, ooh, I'm saying this, and it's not exactly what I mean, but I think like I'm distorting the truth, or I'm protecting this person. Like,
yeah,
I think I also apply this, and there's obviously you can go. He's not saying tell everyone exactly what you think about them, even if it's negative, right? You don't have to speak, right? He's not saying always say what you think about people or always say the truth, right? An option is not speaking, right? When you don't have anything nice to say. But, and I think we've definitely talked a lot about this, and I've seen you practice this, I know, but like speaking the truth when asked upon, even when it's hard, even when it's honest and difficult, is helpful to people, right? Yeah. It goes back to the friendship thing you're talking about and having people who are willing to tell you the hard truth. Like, it's hard, but in the long run, it's better. It does no good to hide reality from people when they're oblivious to it.
Yeah. It's so freeing too. He uses the example a lot of times in this book about like just a wife who is like, or just like spousal relationships, you know, and like there's something going on in the marriage and you know, just like the relationship's deteriorating, and it just led from this like unwillingness of one spouse or the other to just admit that they were feeling resentful about this little thing.
Yeah.
And it just inflated and inflated and inflated, and they just couldn't take it anymore. You know, so just saying the truth, even though it might hurt initially, is just so powerful and just tends to quell the issue, yeah. I think. Anyway.
I think I have more to say on that, but I think it'll actually tie into number 10.
Sweet. I agree. Those are very related, yeah. And I'm having trouble distinguishing between the two, so we can talk about it then probably.
Yeah, let's touch on 9, then we'll come back to 10. All right, 9. Assume the person you are listening to might know something you don't.
Very good. The cliche example, my chair is squeaking, my bad. Yeah. I see you looking around. I'll make sure to squeak more now. I'll tell you what I got to do is I got to stand up straight with my shoulders back. That way I don't lean against the...
Do you want me to go grab that other chair while you're talking?
I mean, if it's bothering you that much.
Yeah. Go ahead and just keep talking.
Be honest. Tell the truth. Is it bothering you?
Yes,
it is. All right. Okay. We'll go grab the chair then. All right. Okay. But yeah. So the cliche example that, I don't know if it's cliche. I've heard it lately is, you know, that thing where, thank you for that chair. It's awesome. I'm going to just get in this chair and then I'll finish my thought. All right, here we go. I'm getting in the chair now. Dylan, say something while I'm getting in the chair. Go ahead.
So I'm in your microphone right, now and I'm pushing the chair.
Okay, got it. So you can sit in. Okay, great. I've got the chair now. I'm in the chair. That was quite an adventure we had. All right.
I enjoyed that.
So, anyway, so the cliche thing that about this rule that I think of is, you know how when you're in a group, I've done this before 100 times, I still do it. When you're in a group and someone's talking, it's a group discussion, and you literally have no idea what that person is saying. You're just thinking about the thing that you're going to say after that person done talking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, I have no idea what you said, but I'm going to completely change the subject about the thing that I was thinking about because it's more important.
I do that like 95% of the time on this podcast.
Oh, really?
Nice. No, that's a joke.
Okay. Dylan's like, boring, next.
Dude, anyway, I haven't listened to you in at least 6 episodes.
That may be a good choice. Anyway. But, hey, if you're a listener and you feel that pain in your chest, like I've just been called out, then it's okay. Fix it. Assume that the person you're listening to knows something that you don't.
Yeah. That's an interesting application of it. Yeah. I think of this and I think it applies to both of these situations, but I think of this more so in the situation where, like, I don't know, you're debating something and you like just write somebody off because you think or you know that their opinion is wrong.
Yeah.
I think that I'm pretty good at this rule. I do try to be open-minded in dialogue and really like give people the benefit of the doubt of like, you have this opinion is different from me. It could be that you have information that I don't. Right. And that's not always the case, but often it is, honestly. And I think if we don't do this, we really, really shut ourselves into like a narrow worldview.
Yeah. Amen. Yeah, that's so true. That's so true. I just to say something about that really quick. I think we Catholics, as you know, fellow sinners, have a lot to learn from that sort of advice. Just because I feel like there's a lot of just incoherent shouting among we Catholics of, oh my gosh, the left, the liberals, their opinions are insane. How could they ever think that? Blah, 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 blah. When in fact, 85% of us, I'll dare to say, don't have a single fleshed out thought about what they actually believe. And, you know, it's like with transgenderism or abortion or, you know, which are sinful things deeply,
yeah.
You know, fundamentally. But we haven't given it a second of thought other than shouting that we think it's sinful. And we don't have any fleshed out opinions. And In fact, we listen to someone who has these opinions, that, you know, has thought about them, we might be able to have a conversation that might get us somewhere.
Yeah.
So I think it's just really valuable, I think, for us fellow sinners, Catholics, to learn from this when approaching liberal folks.
Right. And just to be clear, you said abortion and transgenderism, deeply sinful. By transgenderism, you just mean the idea that male and female are totally interchangeable and you can become one or the other, not someone who struggles with gender identity.
Correct.
Okay, just making sure I can clarify that. All right. Number 9. Do we have more on that?
No, I'm good.
No, I think that's good. I think we covered it. Assume they know something that you don't. Number 10. This definitely is connected to 8, and like this might be my other favorite, so maybe we just combine them together and say these are our favorites. Be precise in your speech is number 10. Wow. Wow, wow, wow. I love this one. This one I really strive to do. And I think as an intellectual, whatever that means, this is something I really value, right? When I'm communicating, when I am expressing ideas, I think this is something that I think Peterson, the way Peterson talks about it is like, if you're not precise, it leads to miscommunication and arguments. I think he talks about this in the context of like a marriage, right?
A little bit. He definitely talks about it in context of a marriage. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But I think both in like relationship and in like discussing important ideas, this matters a lot. Because when you're not precise, you communicate falsely. And it's a really hard thing to do because we're not going to communicate precisely all the time. We're going to make mistakes in the way we communicate things. But it matters a lot that we strive for precision.
Right.
I actually had a student, this happened like last spring. He asked me a question about some moral teaching in the church or something. And I gave him a very like clear, I think, but nuanced answer. And he just like reacted to it. He's like, "Mr. Jedlebeck, when you speak, you're always like really precise." And when he said that, I was like, yeah, I hope so. Like, because like, I don't want to say something vague that you misinterpret and like misapply, especially when it comes to like controversial moral issues. Cause I think that happens way too much, is we just speak in generalities. Even go back to like when you said transgenderism, right? Like people hear that at times and interpret that totally contrary to what you want.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important to be precise in our speech.
Yeah, that's true. That's good. Yeah. One of the reasons why I find this a little bit, well, very related to rule number 8, tell the truth or at least don't lie, is because he mentions the story in the chapter that I think is just really powerful. It's called There's No Such Thing as a Dragon. And basically, it's like a really short story about this son who sees a really, really small dragon in their house, and just like he goes, "Mom, there's a dragon in the house." He's like, "I don't see a dragon. What are you talking about?" And the dragon gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and like takes over the house and is as big as the house. And the son's like, "Hey, what's going on with the dragon?" And my mom's like, the mom still doesn't see the dragon, but you know, as soon as the mom, you know, sees the dragon, you know, whatever, gets small, disappears or whatever. So the idea was like, you know, naming that thing, no matter how, you know, unavoidable or avoidable, mm-hmm. it you want it to be,
mm-hmm.
Removes the power of that thing in one's mm-hmm. life. Mm-hmm. So, he uses the example of like, a woman who discovers that her husband has been cheating on her. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, he talks about how the woman, could have, you know, addressed issues that the husband was dealing with way early on before he went the route of cheating on her, even though it's not all the wife's fault that the husband cheated on her, but still, you know, just naming things, naming dragons in one's life, you know, before they become so large that they can't be handled, kind of a thing, you know? So that's what he talks about in this rule, which in my opinion is, you know, almost indistinguishable from rule number 8.
Yeah. Well, and this also connects to one of my bonus rules that I added, which is from his second book, is 12 More Rules for Life Beyond. What is it?
Yeah. Beyond Order.
Beyond Order. Yep. This one's Antidote to Chaos. The second one's Beyond Order. And the rule that I mentioned is do not hide unwanted things in the fog. And I think this is connects to that, the aspect of it that you were just talking about, right? Like not bringing things to the light that need to be brought to the light. Because, yeah. And I think this is so true relationally. And I think about my relationships where like I have this thing, it's not a big deal, maybe. Or maybe it might be, might not, right? It's a small thing. It's a small issue that I'm dealing with, or like, you know, it's bothering me about the other person or whatever, right? It's a small thing. I can kind of leave it there hiding in the fog, not bring it to the light. And then it just kind of grows and grows and grows and grows and turns into resentment eventually.
Yeah.
And then it gets to the point where maybe it is tied in with six other issues and you don't really know how to talk about it.
Right.
Because it's just mixed in with all this resentment.
Right.
And at that point, sometimes it's done a lot of damage to the relationship versus as soon as you recognizing it, bringing it to the light, taking out of the fog, identifying it, naming it, it's so much easier to deal with in those moments.
It's a really good rule.
That is a good rule. I wish I wrote it.
Indeed. Really good rule.
Alrighty. Numero 11.
Aha.
Do not bother children. I love this one. Sorry, I shouldn't have stopped. Do not bother children when they are skateboarding. What a just incredible rule.
Powerful one.
I just love the, like, nobody knows what it means if they haven't heard it right now, but I just love how, like, I don't know. I love, it doesn't really connect. And you'll see how it connects once we talk about it. But, like, it just seems like such a trivial thing. Like, why is it so important that I don't bother children when they're skateboarding? Like,
yeah,
that's one of the rules for life. Like, but it's not really about children skateboarding. But this is, I think, a good example of, did I bring this up earlier? No, that was the cat. But this is a good example of, like, it's not about the thing, but the thing demonstrates what it's about.
Yeah.
So, and you've read it more recently than me. So add or, you know, correct where I go wrong. Children skateboard, it can be a nuisance, right? It seems disorderly and they're skateboarding in a, you know, on staircase in a public place and it's getting in people's way, right? And so you come in and you say, hey, don't skateboard here, right? And it cramps their style and they run off all mad and then they're, you know, pissed off at the man, right? Well, that's actually not good for them, right? Children need, and especially like boys, need space to roam and feel free and to try things. And if we are too rigid in our view, or not our view of things, but our, you know, our expectations for how they conduct themselves, then we're actually stifling their creativity and their expression.
Yeah, that's good.
Is that fair to say?
That's good. Yeah, that's good. I have to say, we're building like $1 million, $2 million brand new skate park in Huntsville.
Oh, really?
Yeah, over at John Hunt.
Well, good.
Building one, yeah.
Jordan Peterson would be proud.
Yes, he would, yeah. And I saw the other day, I saw a couple skateboarders over there, like, skateboarding on the construction. It's not done yet. Mm-hmm. I was just like, what a skateboarder thing to do.
Yeah.
To, like, go to the, like, construction site and skateboard.
Yeah. Yeah. Which anyway. I bet you didn't bother them.
No, we did not, yeah.
Did you think about JP?
No, that was before I read JP's. Okay. So, anyway, yeah. I just thought I'd bring that up. Yeah, I feel very relieved thinking about this rule.
I kind of do too.
Yeah, one of the examples that I thought was just so, so eye-opening that he uses is his mom, one time when he was a kid, was employing this rule. So Jordan Peterson was, you know, basically fighting during a baseball game that they were playing out in the yard or whatever with another kid, like about to go, you know, punching each other and stuff. And his mom walks out and walks by. All the kids see that she's walking by, and all the kids see that she sees. And she chooses not to say anything, which, honestly, 99 mothers out of 100 probably would have said something and stopped that.
Mm-hmm.
But the point that Jordan Peterson made was that his mother was allowing him to be dangerous, to maximize the risk of the situation, to be a kid, you know, and to grow into manhood in that way, you know.
Right.
Otherwise, she would be stifling him.
Yeah.
I thought that was such a good example of like, man, I don't need to nitpick boys in particular. By the way, he talks a lot in this chapter about
when he says that, so while you're on that point, just to clarify, is he say this is generally for everyone and then says especially for boys? Like, how does he approach the gender?
He uses the rule particularly for boys. Okay. And one of the reasons is that he thinks that our society is stifling the ability of men to grow because of the feminist movement, mm-hmm. In the quote unquote gender equality movement. Yeah. That's what he thinks. Yeah. And, this rule is particularly for boys.
Yeah.
He just makes the point of allowing boys to be dangerous mm-hmm. and risk takers. And like I said before, maximizing risk just so that they know where that ceiling is, so that they know that they're capable of doing things is very, very important.
And in situations where they can fail without it being detrimental.
Right.
Right. It's like the playground type environment. The playground maybe is a great analogy or a great example of this. I think of this frequently in my work as a teacher and as a coach, like especially with boys. I know you coach girls, but I think of this frequently because so often the temptation is to like control and squash and create order. But at times I realize it's like, no, I need to let them be boys. I need to let them. And I think in so many ways the traditional classroom environment is better suited towards the success of girls than boys. And sometimes it gets, you know, ADHD is the excuse or whatever, but like boys tend to be more active, and activity in the traditional classroom environment is not rewarded, right? Sitting still and listening is rewarded. And so I think of this frequently. Because of the traditional classroom environment and seeing boys struggle with that. And it's one of the things I love about coaching, actually. And I know you'll relate to this, but I think it's one of the reasons why you see teenagers especially come to life on the athletic field. It's because they're given this space where they can run, where they can make mistakes, where they can fight even, like without having, you know, their lives in jeopardy. Like it's this free space to run, to be themselves, to compete, to lay their hearts on the line, like to practice giving everything. And I don't know. It's just such a beautiful thing.
Yeah. So healthy, isn't it? Yeah.
And I think also good parenting advice too, you know, I think parents' natural instinct is to protect, but at times you also have to give them space to run.
Yeah. Yeah. My favorite quote from this chapter, I shared it with you earlier, is, if you think strong men are dangerous, just wait until you see what weak men are capable of.
Yikes.
That's a really, really, hammer on the nail line.
Does he give an example?
No, he doesn't. That's like his second to last sentence of the chapter. Yeah. But, you know, he talks a lot about, you know, the Columbine boys who, Columbine High School in Colorado, who, you know, killed several of their classmates and then committed suicide. You know, he talks about them.
Yeah. Well, and those are, it's funny. We just did a active shooter training type thing with the police department. And one of the things they're emphasizing is like those kinds of people, they're weak. Like they're not like they're doing that because they're weak and because they're cowards.
Yeah.
Actually. I think that demonstrates the point very well. It's like what weak men are capable of creating mass chaos.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Number 12.
Last melon.
Get a cat and pet it every day.
No, that's not the rule.
What's the rule, Nate?
This is the only one that I've read. Cool. Okay. Pet a cat when you encounter one on the street.
Good job reading.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm pretty articulate when it comes to reading 8-word sentences.
Yeah, you're a good reader.
Thank you. Would you like to have a stab at it?
Okay, so when you encounter a cat, on the street. I actually forget. I asked you to explain this one, but I forget.
I'll explain.
Yeah, you go.
I can explain. Yeah. It's funny. At the beginning of this chapter, he spends a large amount of time talking about like the fact that he loves his dog. And the reason that he does that is because he doesn't want to alienate all the dog lovers by titling the chapter after cats.
Anyway, he knows his audience.
Yeah, he does. He does. But no, for real, he spends a lot of time in this chapter talking about just like the terrible struggles that his daughter, Michaela, has had physically, and just the suffering that she has had to endure and their family has had to endure as a result. And just he wrestles a lot with like why we have such limitations as human beings. And the thrust of this chapter is, you know, there is suffering. That's life. And we have limitations as human beings. That's life. And that's hard. But at the end of the day, we can take a second, and we should take a second to, you know, take in moments of wonder and moments of gratitude.
Yeah.
And his example that he uses is, you know, petting cats.
Pet a cat. It's not about petting the cat. But petting the cat helps you realize what it's about.
Indeed.
Yeah. This is a good one. I like this. I'm trying to think what the cats are in my life that I need to pet metaphorically.
Yeah. By the way, he makes a really interesting point about cats. He says, dogs have been tamed. That's why they're hanging around with human beings. But he says cats, like, seem to have made a conscious decision to allow human beings to be a part of their lives. I think that's a really good point.
I remember that point, yeah.
I think that's so true. They do give that like impression, don't they? It's like, I'm going to allow you into my life, but I could leave whenever I want because I'm a cat.
They're still in control.
Yeah, they are. That's right.
So fascinating.
That's cool, yeah. Anyway.
But yeah, I mean, there are so many ways in which it's like we aren't open to encounter. You know, you think about his last episode, I guess, where we talked about like encountering the gospel, right? We can be so closed-minded, so shut off into our world or focused on our day-to-day that we're not open to encountering like the most important things. Encountering beauty, ultimately, yeah. I think, is one thing I think of with this rule.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, one of the things, like my particular example lately is I was playing soccer and I slid on the ground and I scraped up my knee. Just it's not a big deal at all. It's just a scrape. But you know how the body does is it creates the scab, and then over time the scab decreases and it becomes back to normal. My body literally heals itself.
Yeah.
Like my knee was injured, and here in like a couple weeks ago, and here in a week or so, I'm looking at my scab now, it's gonna be gone and back to normal. My body literally heals itself. I mean, that's amazing. So I was just spending some time. I've been spending some time on that lately, just reflecting on how incredible that is. That I have a body. I'm like literally Wolverine, you know.
Metaphorically,
Wolverine. No, literally I have. No, in a sense, I'm literally Wolverine. My body literally heals itself, and not in a full sense, of course.
Okay, but
in
some sense.
Yeah. And that's incredible. And just spending time to reflect on that, I think, has been really meaningful for me personally. So that's one particular example.
Yeah. I think that in some ways, actually literally doing this rule would be a good way to experience the reality of it, right? Because what do you have to do to pet a cat on the street? Like, you have to slow down. You have to stop. You have to forget about where you're going for a second.
Yeah.
And just be in the moment. And then do something physical, right, that grounds you in reality as well. So I think that's next time you see a cat in the street, try this one literally. And if it bites you, well, then it bites you.
It's best be hoping it's not a mountain lion or something like that. That'd be crazy.
Yeah. Dude, did I ever tell you about – we don't have time for this because you don't want to know how long this is. But did I ever tell you about the legend of Fort Collins, Colorado, who killed a mountain lion?
I think you may have, but maybe that'll be our next episode.
Just all on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it'll take 1 minute. So.
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. But like literally, so it was like when I was living in Fort Collins, Colorado, there's this hike, Horsetooth. Have you done it?
No. That sounds really familiar.
Yeah. Horsetooth Reservoir. There's Horsetooth there. Mountain. Yeah. So this hike I probably did 12 times. Like I very frequently did it while I lived out there. And during this time, there's this news story. It makes national news about this guy hiking Horsetooth Rock, this hike that I've done at least a dozen times, got attacked by a mountain lion, but strangled it to death.
While you were there?
No, I was not on the hike at that time.
No, I just mean while you were
there. While I was living there, yeah. Like, on this trail that I frequently hiked. Like, this was the news story. It's like this guy, and he's like interviewed on the news. It's just this like local like folk hero who
like
was attacked by a mountain lion, but strangled it to death. And then a little bit later, kind of a news story came out. It's like, it was a juvenile lion, mountain lion.
Had
but
to have
like,
been. Seriously. It had to have been. But
like, still, like, that's.
But you know, 100 years from now, it's going to be like the biggest mountain lion that anyone has ever seen.
No, because he strangled it to death.
Oh, dang.
Oh, I see what you're saying. In the story.
Yeah, the story. Yeah.
See, I was thinking more about like deer and how deer, like if you miss a deer, like next season, it's like bigger.
Oh yeah,
but no, that's
no,
not
yeah. What sorry, I meant like in the yeah. lore, it's yeah, gonna yeah. be like, you know, the biggest mountain lion
anyone's
ever seen.
6,000 pounds.
It was unbelievable. Yeah, yeah. And then this man, with the flick of his finger, flung the okay. Anyway,
anyway, yeah, yeah.
Jordan Peterson.
Don't pet a mountain lion. Only if it's a
that's right.
tame little cat. All right. So those are his 12 rules. I recommend reading the book. You can engage him in audio format. He's all over YouTube and podcast providers and all that stuff. You know, not perfect in everything he says, but definitely there's a lot to learn from as Christians, even to learn from the things he has to say and the ways that he can like convict us of our values, of our stories, like the ways that he's owned our stories in scripture. We certainly have a lot to learn from. Any last words?
No.
I knew you were going to say that. All right. This has been a long conversation. And now I'm just drawing it out. So I'm going to say, praise be Jesus Christ.
Now and forever.
Amen.